Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate Pick Your Own Farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. If you're tired of partisan debates and find yourself tuning it all out, you're probably part of what a huge new survey calls the exhausted majority. The report comes from the group More in Common, which studies social divisions and works to reduce them. It's an initiative that started in Europe, in countries with their own polarized debates, such as France, Germany, and Hungary. Now More in Common is working in the U.S., and its research finds we do have more in common than you might think, but also that breaking down those barriers is a gargantuan task, given the financial, political, and technological forces working against Americans coming together. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest joins us from New York City. He's Dan Vallone, U.S. Director of More in Common. Dan is also a native Granite Stater. Up until recently, he was with the public education advocacy group Reaching Higher NH. He also served as an officer in the Army and is a veteran of the Afghanistan War. Dan Vallone, a big welcome back. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Laura. It's great to be here.
Well, you describe in this report, Dan, the polarization in our society, the social fragmentation, as a crisis. Now, that's a powerful word, Dan. What's the crisis as you see it?
No, it is, and we use it intentionally. And our research and others by groups such as Pew and other kind of polling groups finds that 9 out of 10 Americans say that the country is more divided now than at any other point in their lifetime, and that overall trust in democratic institutions is at near record lows. So we are at an inflection point as a country where we feel more divided than we have ever been, and we see the real consequences in the sense that we can't make progress on any number of really significant issues. We just are unable to make traction, and so we did this report out of a desire to better understand what actually is driving this polarization, and then how and what are the methods we can find to come together as a society.
So the crisis is we are so divided we can't work together to solve common problems, Dan.
In some ways, it's even more complex and worse off than that, because what our research finds is we are deeply divided, and America is the most polarized democracy that we have surveyed, and we've now worked in 5 different countries. But what we also find in America is that we're not at the grassroots level. When you go and talk to people, we're actually not as divided as we think we are, but our politics and our media is really dominated by the most polarized actors in our society, and they're the ones who are kind of controlling a narrative and fueling this perception of that we can't come together. And so we have these structural and systemic issues that are preventing us from making progress and coming together that we have to address before we can really realize a stronger sense of collective goal and collective ambition as a nation.
Well, it's easy to be nostalgic, Dan, about earlier times, you know, kumbaya, everybody got along. I mean, how much worse really do you think our divisions are? Is there any data to back up this feeling of divisiveness, or is it just a feeling?
I think there's lots of data, and whether you look at some of the metrics that I just mentioned, trust in democratic institutions, but also things like split ticket voting, which means, you know, I vote for a presidential or a Senate candidate from one party, and then I vote for a governor or a state representative from a different party. That has collapsed across the country, and so you see just the nationalization of every election where people are voting single party down the line. And that is a relatively new phenomenon in America. And so that is, again, a real concrete manifestation of this polarization. But I think your point is also one that's really important, is that there is this semblance of nostalgia that sometimes you're in people who are often described as centrist, saying we need to return to this time when we were kind of more together as a society. And I think that that's the wrong framing to approach this. We can't, one, it's just impossible to turn time backwards. But also, two, I mean, we are at, there are real underlying demographic, economic issues underpinning a lot of this polarization. And so we have to look forward. We have to be thinking about what is the new path, what is the new sense of American identity that can bring us together as across our lines of division, because it's not going to be a restoration of something from eons past. It's going to be something new.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I definitely want to talk to you about that. What is the new path for moving forward? But first to what's gone on right now, Dan. So what are the two or three leading factors behind these divisions? We could talk all day about this, but what sort of jumps out at you having done this research?
Yeah, I think so. There's three. I would categorize it across three different buckets. So the first is we have incentive structures that are fueling polarization, and that looks at financial incentives from media companies, social media companies, in the sense of the very business model of a lot of the largest social media companies actually, benefit from very extreme narrative stories, kind of all that kind of stuff. The second is we do have structural issues. There's two main dimensions. One is a genuine geographic sorting across the country. So people are living closer to people who vote and are very similar in lots of different ways. And that's a reality. And the other kind of structural condition is some of the voting systems that we have. So if you think about most elections are you have to choose either between candidate A, candidate B from two different parties. That doesn't leave a lot of room for people to express a third or a fourth or a fifth kind of position on issues. And then the third category, I would say, is pretty profound misperceptions about one another. And it's a consequence of a bit of the first two categories, but really we have found in our data that people have a very skewed sense of people's positions on various issues. On average, we overestimate people's partisan position by about 20 percentage points on any number of really important issues. And we also find that the more partisan someone is, the more extreme they perceive their opposition to be. So we actually have a really hard time identifying who the people are that we disagree with and what their stance are.
What are the financial incentives, getting to that first bucket you talked about, Dan, for pitting people against each other? And your report says, I'm quoting here, tribal outrage works as a business model for social media, cable TV, talk radio. So what are the financial incentives for inflaming these divisions?
Yeah, I think unfortunately inflammatory conduct is a good business model. And I think that you've seen both on social media with Facebook, Twitter in particular, in and around election cycles, you're seeing a massive increase in this in terms of extreme ads being posted, being shared. Even just recently in the aftermath of the tragedy in New Zealand, they had to remove 1 million posts that were up prior to that tragic shooting and that were there. I mean, so there is this clear unwillingness on the part of a lot of social media actors to try and really change the underlying financials of their model in ways that is allowing and expanding the reach of very violent, very hateful rhetoric. And then that gets picked up through a lot of other various media channels so that we get a lot of coverage on extreme positions. I think the second other financial incentive that we've seen massive media consolidation over the last 20, 30 years where this is down to things as big as the Disney and 21st Century Fox merger, AT&T and Time Warner, but also the FCC allowing larger ownership shares in local markets. So you've seen the collapse in a lot of markets across the country of any local media presence. And there was just a study released that shows when a locality loses its newspaper, you see a decrease in split ticket voting. So you see a more polarized partisan response when people lose some of those local connections where they can feel and really engage with their fellow neighbors outside of the partisan kind of news constructs.
In fact, we did a whole program on the collapse of local newspapers, referencing that study you just mentioned, Dan. But just for the uninitiated, some of our listeners aren't on Twitter. They may not be on Facebook. They may not be engaging in social media at all. Just explain how outrage equals dollars.
Yeah, sure. So, basically the social media companies make money by selling advertising to any number of commercial entities, nonprofits, political campaigns, businesses. But the way that they make their ads more effective and increase the reach of their ads is by gathering data from the users, people who are on Facebook, people who are on Twitter. And so the more they can get people to click on ads in Facebook or in Twitter, the more data they can collect, the more accurate they can make their advertising products, and so the more money they can charge. So they have a huge incentive to try and get people to click on ads or posts or to reshare, retweet. And what they have found over now the 15 years that we've had social media companies really with us is that the more extreme you make a post, the more likely it is to be shared, the more likely someone's going to click through onto that, and so the more data that they are gathering. So the very model is predicated upon people exploiting this kind of desire to click on something that seems extreme or divisive.
And what's behind that? Why do we click on it? Why don't we just say, oh, that doesn't look good, forget it?
Well, I think, yeah, it's a great question, and I think it gets to a lot of different variables that on some level, and we've measured this across a number of countries, you know, you do see some very understandable sources of unease and anxiety. I mean, there are these huge shifts that are happening in terms of the labor market. I mean, just think about companies like Uber and Lyft that are just dramatically changing how we think about transportation, and you see other similar kind of AI changes to how we think about lots of different kinds of work. So people are anxious. And when you are anxious or in a state of heightened anxiety, you are more likely to try and find and identify with ads or just content that appeals in some nature to a kind of tribal identification. So if you see something that says, you know, this group that is different from you is extreme, if you're in a state of anxiety, you're more likely to click on that because it's affirming your identity as a member of an in-group and reinforcing this perception that there is an out-group that is kind of causing your problems.
Wow. So people are feeling anxious. So they turn to something that, in a way, makes you more anxious. Look at all these bad people who are out to undermine you.
Yes. Yep. And then
that's a downward spiral, Dan.
It's a very downward spiral. And you see it. You see all of these studies coming out now saying, look, when people take a break from Facebook or Twitter or social media in general, like their sense of happiness goes up markedly. Their sense of connecting with other people goes up significantly. So it is a bit of a self-reinforcing negative cycle, but it's also, and this gets into all kinds of consumer research, it's unfortunately a highly addictive habit. And I think that that's the other really big issue that we have to address from a lot of different dynamics is that social media and kind of more partisan media in general is addictive. There's this cathartic outlet when you get to watch someone that is kind of expressing outrage for you on behalf of you. And unfortunately, that appeals to some innate kind of aspects of our social and behavioral psychology.
You feel affirmed.
You feel affirmed, and you kind of validates this perception that you have about why problems exist in our society or in our world. And unfortunately, it kind of causes you to double down in some of those misperceptions.
How much can you blame the social media companies, which is, there's a lot of blame towards the social media companies recently, including one of the co-founders of Facebook saying this is too big, it's too dangerous, break it up. But at some level, and we're kind of going there, Dan, Americans are buying into this. I mean, if people are as upset about political divisiveness as they told you they were, you know, this huge exhausted majority that is saying a pox on both of your houses, why do they keep engaging in this stuff? I mean, it's kind of our own fault, isn't it?
I think that you don't want to overestimate the extent to which this is purely a function of the social media companies. Totally agree that there's a lot of individual and community behaviors that we'd love to see change in ways that would move us towards greater social connection. With that said, I think the social media companies, and again, media more broadly, it is a substantial variable here. It is a huge influence. And a lot of it, I think part of the problem is that we don't fully still understand what we're getting into when we participate in social media. And so I think that because it's free, because I can join effortlessly and then derive some real benefit from it, I'm sharing, I'm connecting with some group of my friends, it's hard to see the connections to the ads that then appear in my newsfeed or in my kind of Twitter scroll that are really hateful. And like it's hard to see the connections sometimes. And so I do think that an important effort that, irrespective of where someone stands at the political spectrum, we should all want to try and make it much clearer the costs that are being imposed on individuals and our communities by kind of participating in this business model that social media companies have made.
Let's go to our listeners, Dan. And again, today in The Exchange, we're looking at a huge new survey that finds most Americans are tired of partisan divides. They want to reduce political polarization. They are members of what the study calls the exhausted majority. The study comes from a group called More in Common, which researches social divisions and works to reduce them. It's an initiative that started in Europe. Now it's working in the U.S. We're talking with the U.S. Director of More in Common, Dan Vallone. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. What's your take on why our political lives seem so divided today? What do you think the best way is to reduce these divisions? And how willing are you to reach out to those with whom you strongly disagree? We'd love your thoughts. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan, Helen is calling from Wanalancet. Hi, Helen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Helen.
I just feel that language is a huge part and a part of the effect that we have on other people. And I think all of us learned at some point in our life that if we really want to get something done, how we say it makes a huge amount of difference. I agree with this speaker. He's right on target. Social media hurts, but I also feel that we in ourselves know when we're speaking from our heart and when we're speaking from our digestive system.
Helen, what a great way to put it. Speaking from the heart and from our digestive system.
Love it.
That's brilliant. What do you think about the word or the way she talks about the use of language, Dan? I myself hear people using language in the public sphere that they would not have used 20 years ago.
Yep, I think that it's very true. And I too like the way that she framed it. Thank you, Helen. And I think that we have, you know, an unfortunate truth that we've come in to realize, and maybe it actually isn't unfortunate, is that we have seen a degradation of norms that I think people, particularly more politically active people, really thought that there were these norms for how we treat one another that we thought were really fixed in our political and cultural debate. And we've seen that actors will break those norms and that they are, and there's very little consequences in way of kind of punishment or any kind of retroactive treatment after they've broken the norms. And that's true. I think that is part of what is driving what we call the exhausted majority to check out from politics, that they just say, we don't like this rhetoric. We don't want to hear this rhetoric. We think that it is kind of just coming from all sides. And so we're going to retreat away from those kinds of political and cultural debates. And as a result, what we also see happening is as this exhausted majority and the exhausted majority, like, they have lots of different positions on issues. They're not centrists in the way that we typically use that language. But as members of the exhausted majority kind of retreat from the political and cultural debates, you see that space being taken by more extreme actors. And so it fuels this cycle of, if you look on, you know, cable news, social media, or even just in mainstream media outlets, the narratives and the stories continue to become the more extreme, the more kind of divisive language that none of us think is good, and yet we are stuck in this cycle.
By the way, we've been hinting at this, so let's get right into it. The exhausted majority, this is one of seven groups that you guys found in your massive survey of Americans and your in-depth conversations with them. The exhausted majority is more than 60% of Americans, Dan. That's surprising to me.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's close to 70% of the country.
Wow.
Yep, and it's fascinating because, so again, we do segmentation studies. That's our, as a research organization, that's our specialty, is that we use polling, focus groups, surveys, interviews, and we focus on identifying people's values and belief systems. We, you know, rather than using the standard kind of demographic, you know, women or men believe this on the basis of race, right? We think that values and beliefs provide a more powerful kind of indicator of where people stand, and so that's what we found with this exhausted majority.
All right, coming up, we'll look at some more of the groups that you identified in this survey, what they believe, how much they are willing to find common ground, and we'll keep taking your calls, 1-800-892-6477, or your emails, exchange@nhpr.org. More of our conversation with Dan Vallone in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The main reason I decided to incorporate NHPR into my estate planning is because it absolutely is an essential part of my day.
Robert Cody of Deerfield.
Doing so with an IRA account is a very tax-efficient way of transferring your assets to the future.
Fund the future of NHPR by naming us as a beneficiary to your IRA. Learn more about this and other plan giving options at nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, a new study from a group called More in Common, which looks at social and political divisions among Americans and works to reduce them. It's an initiative that started in Europe. Now it's in the U.S. And one of its key findings, most Americans, more than 60%, are what the report calls the exhausted majority, turned off by the extremes on both sides and feeling forgotten by the political process. Let's hear from you. What's your take on why our political lives seem so divided today? What do you think might help reduce these divisions, bring people with different worldviews together? And what's more important, sticking to your principles and fighting for them, or finding common ground? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Dan Vallone is joining us from New York City. He's U.S. Director of More in Common. He's a native Granite Stater. Up until recently, Dan was with the public education advocacy group Reaching Higher NH. He also served as an officer in the Army. He's a veteran of the Afghanistan War. And Dan, right back to our listeners, Gary sent us an email. And Gary, I can't read the whole thing, but I really appreciate this email. He says, a Republican acquaintance of mine would often tell me racist, nasty jokes about President Obama. Yet if I attempt to discuss the current resident of the White House, he becomes angry and defensive, yelling about the tax and spend Democrats. Gary asks, how do I discuss, for example, the impact of the latest tax cuts to the wealthy and corporations and its impact on our deficit, income inequality, cuts to programs such as the VA, which he uses, when he isn't even open to talking about our differences without getting defensive? Gary asks a very profound question. He says, how do we begin to talk if we can't even agree what the facts are? And Gary, thank you so much. And Dan, I'm sure you heard this from a lot of people that you interviewed for this survey.
Yes, completely. And I think there's other statistics out there that's showing in the past 4 years since late 2015, 2016, these kinds of issues have come up across family dinners, Thanksgiving. There's lots of kind of anecdotal and then statistical truth about the fact that people are feeling as if they can't talk to one another. And it's hard. I mean, and I don't think there's two points I want to make here. The first is there are ways to kind of bridge these moments of division and feelings of not being able to talk to one another. So there are ways to do that better. But second, the issues go much deeper. So again, I think happy to talk a bit about how do we engage again on the individual level.
Right, but to Gary's point, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'd say for Gary, I mean, the first step is to actually not focus on the issues that divide you and your friend, but actually explicitly talk about what are the things that you have in common. Remake that bridge, first build the bridge that reinforces the sense that you and your friend have things in common, whether it's shared experiences, whether it's shared, endeavors that you did in the past, or shared values that you currently know that you and your friend have now. Reinforce the connection along those channels. And then when you have kind of created and reestablished a bond of friendship, you can start to talk a bit about the issues. But what I'd also say is that what we find, this is very true in America, it's true across developed democracies more broadly, the differences that we are experiencing, they are expressed about issues, but they aren't actually about the issue per se. And it's hard to kind of get our hands around this, but what we see happening is that there are two competing narratives about what is happening in our society and how do we move forward. And if you are kind of, if you fall on the liberal side of the spectrum, you're viewing a lot of the issues through this framing that we have serious structural problems that have, marginalized certain communities throughout our history, and that we need large systemic governmental action to try and change those historic inequities. If you're on the more conservative side of the spectrum, your narrative, your story about what's happening is much more about individuals making choices defined by individuals' character, and that there are, again, you have a lot of agency and you experience consequences for your actions. And so that's the underlying difference that is kind of, we see it in how people vote and fall on various specific issues. And so I would talk to that language. I would try and figure out, like, why is it that this person feels X and Y about a certain issue? Because odds are it gets back to that underlying difference in how people see society at a much deeper level.
So a very different worldview. One is the more bootstraps view,
yes.
And the other is more, you know, society is stacked against you and we need to remove those inequities in society before people can bootstrap themselves, so to speak.
Completely. What we see, so one of the questions that we use in our surveys is around how much do you believe individuals' personal decisions are responsible for the outcomes in their life versus kind of how much do you think life outcomes are being determined by structural conditions? And you see that division very stark among the more progressive and the more conservative element actors in our society. So that's a very deep divide. And I would try and talk to individuals to get at where do they fall on that question? And that will illuminate a lot about what's going on that is motivating their kind of division in ways that might open up opportunities to connect.
So Gary could work to, I heard somebody say, replace your exclamation marks with question marks. Just start asking questions.
Start asking questions, and I would ask explicit questions like, well, wait, how much do you think life is determined by individual choices and consequences? And why do you feel that way? What has happened, you know, what has your life informed you about that specific connection, causality? And I would also have some self-reflection and think about what is my answer to that question? Do I think that things are structural versus individual choices? And how might I be coming into this conversation with a bit of a bias that prevents me from hearing someone's actual motivation? So I think the long answer in a lot of ways is that this requires both a lot of reflection on our own actions and then a willingness to ask a lot of questions about people that we thought we might have known pretty well, but now we need to really renew those bonds of connections and create space for us to not be just, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, but actually be, you know, neighbors again.
Wow. Gary, thank you so much for the email. We'd love to hear from you. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You know, Dan, Gary talked about how do I even have a conversation about the issues. There's one issue that you surveyed Americans a lot about, and that's the idea that some people feel we've become too politically correct. People are afraid to talk about some of these issues because they'll get jumped on by either side. I want to play a little clip from a Saturday Night Live skit that captured the challenges of dinner conversations about controversial topics like the Me Too movement. In this skit, we're going to hear three couples at a restaurant trying to talk about accusations of sexual misconduct against comedian actor Aziz Ansari and the fallout from those accusations. I think this exemplifies a lot of what you found in this survey, Dan. So let's hear.
I'm sorry. We can talk about it. It's something else. I was just curious what everyone thought. But...
No, of course. We can talk about it. Yeah, I mean, I think we should.
We absolutely should.
Well, it's come to this. I'll go first.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Yes, I will speak on the topic of Aziz Ansari. I think...
Careful.
Yeah, I think that some women... Careful. Or rather, some men have a proclivity.
Careful.
Help me.
Okay, sure. Well, while I applaud the movement.
Watch it.
Again, that's a skit from Saturday Night Live from last year, capturing the challenges of talking about some of these controversial topics. What did Americans say to you, Dan, to this question of, do you feel like people are too politically correct these days?
Absolutely. It's a hugely important point, and the word political correctness is one of those terms that I think lots of people define differently, but also a lot of when you hear it, you have a sense for what it means. And we found two interesting things. One, over 70% of Americans said that, you know, we should protect people from a hateful speech, that like hateful speech is a bad thing in our society. We should try and make sure that it is not hurting people. At the same time, over 80% of the people think that political correctness has gone too far. And I think, interestingly, around the sense of this feeling that people have that they're not able to articulate or express how they're feeling, it's not just a left-right Democrat-Republican thing. We see within both conservative and liberal elements of society, we see members who express, who feel a lot of pressure to conform to a specific viewpoint on issues, on very large and important issues. And there's this tension that people across the spectrum express about the inability to say what they're thinking and not feel judged or punished by their groups. And so, again, it's not a left-right issue. It is, everybody is feeling and experiencing this. And I think it points to the fact that we do need to create more opportunities to have open spaces where we can not be a Democrat and Republican and ask questions. And there's an interesting parallel here where we just in the last week released a major report on Greece. And here's a country that has undergone massive economic dislocation and is also experiencing very difficult issues because they're, you know, in the Mediterranean, so they're seeing lots of migrants and refugees flow up. So there's lots of challenges the country is dealing with, and they still have, you know, their unemployment rate is, you know, multiples of ours. And they are angrier, but they are less divided on issues. And one of the key findings we found is that Greeks feel able to talk about issues. They don't feel this kind of need to self-censor. And I think it's an important lever that we should try and push on to create space where we can take some of the oxygen out of these debates by actually talking and hearing and listening to each other. And it's much harder than I'm making it sound. I mean, this is not something easy to do, particularly when there is very profound differences in our groups. But I think a key societal measure is if people feel more comfortable expressing their viewpoints, they're less likely to turn and find comfort in groups that are more extreme and divisive.
So people feel nervous about saying what they think, not only because they fear criticism or self-censorship from the other group, but even from within people who are largely like them.
Yes, and that, I think, it actually is the second element that is in some ways more profound, because again, this gets back to some of the social and behavioral psychology that we bring into our research. People have it, and this is true of human beings in general, we have a very profound fear of being kicked out or punished by the groups that we identify with. We have a very strong desire to stay within the norms and boundaries of those groups. And so the kind of punishment or the fear of censorship from within our sides, you know, if we want to use that term, is very strong. And it causes people to exhibit very strong self-censorship when they're in their own communities.
Well, and now that censorship can go viral. So it isn't just,
yes,
you know, your colleague saying, hey, I'm really, you know, I'm thinking of members of the U.S. House, for example. Your colleague doesn't just say to you aside, I'm offended by the fact that you say that. You know, it's out on Twitter and all of a sudden it's out to the world and, you know, you got to hide in your house for a week.
Yep. No, it's true. And I think that gets back to, there's this dynamic where people who are, and what we find, in particularly with the exhausted majority, is it's not, people genuinely understand the complexity of issues. People are, but they might not spend too much time on any one specific issue. So they don't know the vocabulary. They don't know what certain terms mean to people who are very day-to-day dealing with these issues. And so there is this fear of just, I'm going to use the wrong terminology, but I genuinely don't know what the right terminology is, and I feel stuck. And so in that space, what humans do psychologically is, again, we try and identify groups that are like us, and we turn inward towards those elements, which is the opposite of what we actually want, where we want people to kind of come into this space together and say, yeah, I don't know where I stand on this issue, and I don't know what the right word is. I'm trying to find my way towards understanding your position. And we just lack a lot of spaces for that to happen.
So the dialogue doesn't happen. People shut themselves down. They self-censor because they don't want to be outed by the more strident parts of our society on either end.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that one thing that we also saw was that because on social, like, so this is an interesting stat, Pew Research did this one, but 80% of Twitter posts are created by 10% of the users. And so, that just is an indicator of when we look on social media, we see these very extreme kind of narratives that you either get it or you don't, you're in or you're out. And again, that is the voice of a very small number of people. Most people, even on social media, but most people more generally, have pretty nuanced positions on things. One of the defining features of the exhausted majority is lack of consistency. Like they might slightly favor this position on a certain issue that puts them on a more conservative perspective, and on another issue they kind of lean on a liberal way. And that kind of lack of consistency across issues is where a lot of people find themselves. and yet they're unable to articulate those positions because if you don't have a consistent viewpoint, you are judged as an outsider for the more extreme groups.
Again, give us a call. Our guest is Dan Vallone, U.S. director of a group called More in Common that put out this report on political divisions and suggests ways forward, a new path. We will definitely talk about that. We'd love to hear from you. Why do you think our political lives seem so divided today? What do you think is the best way to perhaps reduce these divisions? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. And Dan, let's go to Jim in Swansea. Hi, Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I have not heard you mention the Warren Court in the 1960s departure from the Supreme Court tradition of not involving itself in political issues. Specifically, the 1964 decision, Reynolds versus Sims, which changed the makeup of state senates all the way across the country, stipulating that each one of those would also, in addition to the lower court, have to be determined exclusively on the basis of population. Prior to that, they were, in large measure, in many states, almost all states, determined in large part by population, by geographic differences. In other words, for example, this would change the agricultural area's representation in California to favor San Francisco and Los Angeles. At the time, Everett Dirksen got up on the Senate floor and said, this can't be allowed to stand. Chicago will control all of Illinois. Detroit will control Michigan. New York will control New York. New York City will control New York. Los Angeles and California will control California. And in fact, that is what happened. And at this point, for example, my swimming pool and lawn have more pull when it comes to access to water in California than your farm.
Well, mm-hmm. So talking about, thank you for the call, Jim. So you talked about this earlier, Dan, sort of geographic sorting, but also the way that our electoral systems are drawn, and concern that in some states the cities have all the pull and who cares about the rural voters?
No, absolutely. No, I appreciate the question and the points raised, Jim, so thank you. And I think I would actually, I'd point listeners to, there's an effort called the Madison Initiative. It's run by the Hewlett Foundation, and they work on this issue of trying to figure out how do we make sure that actually the mechanics of our electoral and democratic systems produce outcomes that enable communities to come together across lines of difference. And so what I would talk about, there's two interesting reform efforts that I think are important for states to consider, but also for candidates who are running for higher office to champion. And the first is, and they can be connected, ranked choice voting, and the other is multi-member districts. And so ranked choice voting, which I think New Hampshire is very familiar with because Maine recently passed it and adopted it, but it creates incentives for candidates to appeal to broad segments of the population because you're going to rank candidates for choosing, and potentially someone could be the second choice for a lot of people and actually win the election. And so there, it creates the incentive to be more of a bridge builder than otherwise we have in our current system. And multi-member districts is, again, kind of gets to what Jim was talking about, where in New Hampshire you could imagine collapsing the congressional districts to one district and having the top two vote getters be the elected officials. Again, might not be right for every state, but that creates opportunities to really be representative of all people in the state and to have them feel like their voice is being heard.
Oh, that's really interesting. So that's one of the new paths forward that you mentioned earlier, Dan, toward reducing these divisions. Thank you so much for the call. We'll take more of your calls after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Recently on The Exchange, we explored a particularly New Hampshire institution.
A town minus its general store has a huge hole in it, and people know that. Even if you don't stop at the general store, you want there to be one because you know that that's like having the lights on. It's the pilot light of your town, and if it's out, you feel like there's something wrong.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Every weekday at 9 a.m., only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, it's road construction season, and we talk with Transportation Commissioner Victoria Sheehan. Send your questions for the commissioner before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, a huge new survey of Americans finds we have more in common than you might think. Our guest is Dan Vallone, U.S. director of the group that put out the report. And we've been hearing from you. What's your take on why our political lives seem so very divided these days? What do you think some of the best ways are to reduce these divisions? Send us your ideas, your thoughts, your personal experiences, exchange@nhpr.org, or with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan, right back to our listeners. Ray is calling from Londonderry. Hi, Ray. You're on the air. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. I'd just like to make a comment, and I'll take the response off the air. But for 17 years after 9/11, I was a security consultant traveling all over the country and met people with many different attitudes. And sometimes I had to say things that weren't a lot of fun to hear, though my discussion wasn't political. Some people wanted to make them. But I found in 39 states in the District of Columbia, most of them several times, that if I could strike common ground with somebody in something that I knew something about and they knew something about, for me it was football, baseball, gardening, barbecue, or fishing. The conversation went absolutely wonderful, and they realized, we had common ground. And some of the most pleasant conversations I ever had with people of different race, socioeconomic status, and though I tried to keep my politics separate, I'm sure some of them were, I know some of them were quite different from me. So I'm just make that comment and wonder if there's a response, and I'll take the response off the air.
Ray, it's great to hear from you. Thank you so much. What do you think, Dan?
No, Ray, I love, Ray, that you talked about that, because that's exactly what we found. And I'll also just comment that our team, when we were doing focus groups and surveys, that was the experience people had, is that it was amazing. We did focus groups kind of across with people from across the country, and this was the first really deep dive into the American kind of society for some members of our teams. And they went into some of these focus groups thinking, oh, man, this is going to be a group that disagrees with me very strongly. And they found these connections about, oh, family or sports or, food was often food. Food brings people together. And the enjoyment that people derive from realizing those unexpected connections is profound. And statistically, we know that, for example, when you can experience a sense of awe, it triggers, the release of endorphins and other kind of biological elements that make us happier, more optimistic. And so there's a lot of incentive that we have to try and find these connections across difference, but it's hard. And I mean, not everyone has the ability to travel and engage with different communities. Again, I think it's really true that we've sorted ourselves geographically in ways that make it much more difficult to connect with people across lines of difference. And so we oftentimes meet people only through what we see or what we hear in media.
Well, even some of those areas where it's easier to find common ground that Ray mentions have become political, Dan. There was the football kneeling protests, and a lot of people said, oh, really? Do we have to argue about this, too? When it comes to food, at some events, if you eat a hamburger, people get mad at you because, they think meat is bad for the planet. So it seems like even such safe topics as football and food have become politicized.
It's true. And so that is actually what we find. This is true across the countries that we survey, but it's particularly true in America. Every issue will become polarized. That is the nature of the polarized society, is that there is this enormous incentive structure for divisive elements. I mean, in lots of, that's media, political consultants, social media companies, it is in their incentive to try and make issues as inflammatory as possible. And so one of the strategies that we collectively need to think about is how do we create more content and stories about people coming together, people hearing about commonalities, because again, what we find in what most groups that survey Americans find is that most people, a majority, above 60, above 70%, actually still have lots of commonalities across issue areas, across behavioral and value areas like food, all that. And so we're not hearing that, we're not seeing that, and it's causing us to become even more depressed about the state of our society.
So getting on this idea again of the new path forward that you mentioned earlier, Dan, and you just said something, we need more stories, more awareness that people, yes, indeed, do come together every day to work on improving their local park or whatever. But who's going to click on those stories, Dan? You told us earlier that it's the outrage that, you know, creates eyeballs and clicks and brings money into the coffers of these companies.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's true. And so this is going to be very hard. I think that personally, I am a pretty idealistic, optimistic person, and my journey through the Army and in New Hampshire and in all the places I've lived has taught me at a very deep level that we have so much more in common than we do that divides us, that is very true to me, and I believe that. But the structural conditions that we're facing, the barriers, are substantial. So we have a long and a difficult journey ahead of us, but what it's going to take is we need more actors and groups who don't think of themselves as political groups, and not to act in a political manner, but they need to start explicitly trying to bring people together. Whether you are a chamber of commerce, whether you're a labor union, whether you're an individual business owner, or if you're organizing a sports team, the moment in America that we find ourselves, all of us, if you want to improve the health of our democracy, we have to start thinking, what can I do to actively bridge division? What can I do in my role, whatever that is, whatever you do, what can I do to find ways to create space for people to be open to dialogue and to talk across areas that we disagree with? And it's going to happen. The most impact is going to come from non-political groups. It's going to be the sports teams. It's going to be the local police association, the local community group, faith-based organizations. And it's going to be hard, but we need all of those groups to think about how can we be bridge builders in this moment we find ourselves.
How robust are those groups, though, Dan? We hear that Americans are not the group joiners they used to be, that we're bowling alone, like Robert Putnam wrote some 20 years ago, that we prefer to be in front of a screen than rather meeting people face to face. So you can go to these groups, but will anybody be there?
So it's a good question. And I think it's a bit of a, you know, I think we misperceive the extent to which those groups are not there, because we've stopped asking to a certain extent, and because we've said we've only used old models of, you know, you need to join this civil society group that was around for the last 35 years, and that's the metric that we're measuring in terms of how cohesive are we as a society. And that's when I get to, like, we need new systems. We need new organizations that are going to reach and connect people, because we know both more in common from our research, but also from, again, any number of surveys that have been done around people's sense of isolation, people's sense of loneliness. People want to be connected. They want to be with people that they can talk to and engage with and have real experiences. But the old ways of doing that are just less effective. People are spending more time online. They're more, you know, the way that we work is changing, that you're not going to have the type of corporate social responsibility that we might have had 35 years ago. So we need to be trying new things. And I think that will, as we do it, we will discover that there are more opportunities for success than we currently think there are, because we see the declining membership in traditional measures of social connection, like, you know, Rotary Club or like church attendance. But there's going to be new metrics that we can build that will indicate the same, that will have similar effects for this new kind of identity that we are building.
Go ahead.
No, and I wanted to point to, this is a, and again, I started this job and haven't been in the state for a bit, but one of the efforts that I was involved in that I think a lot about and has, you know, motivated me in this work is Manchester Proud, which is this effort that people from across the political spectrum, from across every possible degree of difference, came together in 2018 in Manchester to say, how can we build a stronger Manchester identity that brings people together, that improves outcomes for kids, students, families, everybody? And that took business, took faith, took university, schools, everybody, Republicans, Democrats, everybody. That type of initiative is new, and we need more of those kinds of efforts in New Hampshire and across the country.
Well, and you talked about your own journey doing this work, your time in New Hampshire, your time in the military. And I want to ask you a little bit about that, Dan, because
sure,
it's interesting and it's relevant to what we're talking about today. So when you were here in New Hampshire, and I mentioned earlier you're a native Granite Stater, you were with a group that some regarded as a bit left-leaning. You've written opinion pieces taking issue with President Trump. So, Dan, how have you now, doing this work, had to do that own work, reconciling your own beliefs with those who think that the president is great?
No, yeah, it's an important question, and I appreciate you asking it, because I want people to be listening to what I'm saying, and so I have to be honest about how my own journey through this space. And you're right, in the aftermath of the 2016 election, I definitely became much more politically active than I'd ever been before. You know, as you know, and I was in the Army, and so most of my adult life, I was intentionally very non-political. And, you know, President Trump's conduct as a candidate and while in office, definitely it hit me, and particularly the moments such as when he mocked John McCain and POWs, that made me angry in a way that was new for me. And I say that knowing that many people have experienced issues across their lives that have caused a similar anger much earlier.
So as a veteran, that hit you especially hard.
It did. It did. And so I started writing and I started acting in a political manner. And I tried to call out what I thought were moments when our elected officials failed to live up to the standard that I think we should hold them to, the standard I think we should hold each other to. But at a certain point, I started feeling conflicted about the work that I was doing. And I realized that I wasn't spending the time that I wanted to on building the thing that brings us together. And I started to realize that no matter what, at some point in the future, President Trump will be out of office, and these divisions will still be with us, and they will be worse if we don't spend time thinking, how are we going to come together and who's building those bridges? And that was what really moved me to find this role with More in Common, where I feel as if my job every day is to try and figure out how do we actually do that? What are the ideas? What's the story going to be that brings people from across all the differences that we have in America? And in America, I think one of the profound beauties of our country is that we are so different. I mean, there's no other country in the world that has the types of differences that we have. And that is a source of tension in so many ways, but it's also this tremendous opportunity that we have to build a new identity that embraces that diversity of identity that we all have. And I wanted to be spending my time doing that. And so for me, this has been an incredibly rewarding and challenging experience. I think as anybody who is trying to engage across lines of difference knows, you do have to be very aware of your own bias, your own, when you're coming into a room, you need to be willing to listen to someone say something that you disagree with pretty profoundly and still ask questions like, why do you feel that way? What has happened in your life that is causing you to think that way about an issue or an experience or an event? But I also got to say, it is unbelievably rewarding to do. It is such a profound sense of joy in some ways to find a connection with someone that you didn't anticipate having or that you actually worked to have. And for me, that it has been in some ways a return to what I experienced in the Army, which was this incredible experience alongside of people who were unbelievably different from me in so many different ways. I mean, politically, racially, religiously, from different parts of the country. But we were all there because we were bound together by an identity that superseded all the parts of us that we brought into it. And so we didn't leave our identities at the door or at the barracks. We brought it into our unit in service of something larger, in service of something deeper. And I think that that type of approach is what we need more of today. We need to find ways to bring our full selves into the community space, but recognizing that as Americans, there is an identity that binds us more deeply than the individual differences that we see, that we hear, that we know of.
Well, and I've heard other veterans say that, Dan, that in the military, you are all committed to the mission. And you appreciate the differences in race or ethnicity or ideology or background, you know, rural, urban. You appreciate those differences, but your number one focus is to come together and focus on the mission. How can we use that military model for this broader goal of bringing Americans together?
Absolutely. You know, and this is where, if you're, you know, the people of New Hampshire get this awesome opportunity to be among the first interrogators of our presidential candidates. And I think this is a question that everybody needs to be asking every single candidate is, what is the unifying vision and initiatives that they're going to launch? And this is across political party, whether Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, anything. What are they going to do? What is the story they're going to tell about who we are as Americans that can bring people together, that is going to embrace all of our diversity and point us towards North Stars that we can all see and orient ourselves towards? And what are the initiatives that they're going to lead to actually physically bring us together? I think one of the beautiful things the military does, unlike few institutions in our country, is that you actually bring people together. You are forced into these experiences that are intense and unique in many ways, but the idea of people serving together from diverse backgrounds is something that we have done in our history and we know is a successful way to bring people together. And research similarly points out that when you do bring people together and have them accomplish something, you reduce perceptions of prejudice. We need something new. And I mean, I had a professor at West Point, Corey Shockey, and she recently wrote a post in the Journal of Foreign Affairs, and she talked about maybe we need a Teach for America for democracy, for bringing people together from across the country and employing them across the world in service of our diplomatic and kind of national security endeavors. Maybe we need something domestic. There are lots of different approaches. They can be liberal, they can be conservative, but the idea is that we need ways to physically bring people together, go after obstacles and challenges together, and see that we have so much more in common through the work that we do together.
How much do you think, Dan, most Americans are interested in finding this common ground, or in a bare minimum, not demonizing each other? Are we really interested in breaking down barriers, or do we just say we are, but in the end, we really just want everybody to think like we do?
77% of the people that we polled said that our differences are not so profound that we can't come together.
77%.
77%. So that's basically 8 out of 10 Americans want to come together, know we can come together.
Wow.
And so, it's tough, though, because, and this was to your point, our individual behaviors, are we acting on that desire? Are we showing, demonstrating that? But part of this, and this is where I get back to, what we need to be asking candidates from every office, from every party, is we need to ask people that being a citizen and being a resident, being a person in America, you have rights and responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities is to be part of the process of bringing us together, and that this isn't going to be something that is handed to us or changed only because someone at the top makes a decision. We're going to lead this together, and we all have to do our part.
All right. Dan, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. This has been great. Really appreciate it.
That's Dan Vallone, U.S. Director of More in Common. If you want to look at More in Common's recent report, of course, we've got it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Once again, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.